Hey, it's Brad Milkey, host of ABC's daily news podcast, Start Here. And I'm honored to say Start Here, along with several ABC audio projects, are up for Webby Awards. Voting is open to the public, and we're all really excited about these awards, but this vote closes on Thursday. So please don't wait. You can go to abcaudio.com/webbies. That's abcaudio.com/webbies, W-E-B-B-Y-S, to cast your vote for Start Here, along with other ABC news shows. We really appreciate it.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Daria Albinger. Coming up, Tyre Nichols laid to rest in Memphis as calls once again grow for police reform.
We've sort of moved beyond defund the police. The most reasonable people recognize that that's not probably the best way to phrase it, and that's not what anyone's really looking for. But find ways to reform policing where it goes from policing to public safety.
It's not the mystery at a museum, but at a zoo after animals go missing.
Whoever put the monkeys in there had to have used flashlights or something. It's cold, it's dark. They could have died in that house.
And you can't change your face, but the use of facial recognition might have you wishing you could.
It is very dystopian. It is very 1984-ish.
All ahead on Perspective. Nearly a week after Tyre Nichols was brutally beaten to death by five Memphis police officers during a traffic stop in January, he was laid to rest at the Mississippi Boulevard Christian Church. The funeral was attended by other families who have experienced an all too familiar grief, including Philonis Floyd, the brother of George Floyd, who was killed in Minnesota, and Eric Garner's mother, Gwen Carr. The death of Nichols brought on renewed calls for federal police reform. At the service for Nichols, it became clear what they want to happen now. ABC Nightline anchor Byron Pitts spoke with Brad Milkey, host of the ABC Daily News podcast Start Here, and provided some more insight.
Tyre Nichols' family never wanted to hold a funeral for him. Not now, less than 30 years after his birth. After he died on January 10th, they were entitled to hold whatever type of service they wanted. Big, small, maybe just close family and friends.
You are my strength.
It seemed like much of their world was welcomed into his funeral. And throughout the service, it became clear that they wanted more than sympathy. They want action.
Don't give up the fight.
Start the day with ABC's Byron Pitts, who's the co-anchor of Nightline. He joins us now. Byron, this was such an emotional scene in Memphis. Can you just describe sort of what stuck out to you as you watched this?
It reminded me, having grown up in the Black church, the magic, the beauty, the majesty of the Black church.
We have come with heavy hearts that can only be healed by the grace of God.
It was a space in which not just the community of Memphis, but all of America and anyone tuned in online. It was an opportunity to grieve.
I promise you the only thing that's keeping me going is the fact that I really truly believe my son was sitting here on an assignment from God.
Yes, to celebrate.
I was born by the river.
To be angry, unapologetically angry.
This is a continuous fight that we have to fight for.
That's right.
We have to fight for justice.
Yeah.
We cannot continue to let these people brutalize our kids.
And then a place to begin the healing, but also begin to strategize. How do we make this anger into something productive?
This is a family that lost their son and their brother.
We heard powerful voices, Vice President Kamala Harris.
At the hands and the feet of people who had been charged with keeping them safe.
We understand that there's needs to deal with crime.
And I want to make special note of Reverend Al Sharpton, right, who certainly has his fans and his critics.
But you don't fight crime by becoming criminals yourself.
But when we talk about the power of the pulpit in the Black church, it is a space in which he is world class. He is a maestro.
In the city that they slayed the dreamer, what has happened to the dream?
This happened in all places. in Memphis, Tennessee, the place where Dr. King died, where he was in Memphis to talk about city employees not being treated as equal workers, the garbage workers.
That had no safety. Two had been killed with a malfunction.
And how in Memphis, Tennessee, the people fought and struggled in particular to give blacks, sanitation workers, rights. They worked to have black men and women on the police force. Fast forward all these years later.
Not far away from that balcony, you beat a brother to death. There's nothing more insulting and offensive to those of us that fight to open doors, that you walk through those doors and act like the folks we had to fight for to get you through them doors.
Hey, you've spent much of the last few days, you've had so many engaging conversations on Nightline, and you heard it at this service, the sort of need for action. I mean, what action is being called for by his family, and what action is on the table in places like Washington? What are the actual reforms that are still sort of on the docket here?
Well, in the short term, his family is calling for peace, which can ever be overestimated, and which we've seen thus far since his death and since that videotape was released. There have been peaceful demonstrations, period, full stop. Also, I think legislative action. You know, the George Floyd bill, which has died in Congress, there's a hope that that might be revisited. We had a conversation this week with the head of the Congressional Black Caucus.
I reject the notion that we cannot do big things, including improving police culture in America.
And I think over time, even the conversation about police reform has become more sophisticated. I think, you know, we've sort of moved beyond defund the police. The most reasonable people recognize that that's not probably the best way to phrase it, and that's not what anyone's really looking for. But find ways to reform policing where it goes from policing to public safety.
You want to be a tough guy? Well, let's get rid of qualified immunity and see if you learn the same manners you have on the white side of town, you'll have some manners on the black side of town.
Because what we all saw in the videotape was the ugliest version of policing that dates back from its foundation in slavery. What I think all reasonable people want is public safety. And public safety is not what any of us saw in that videotape.
ABC's Byron Pitts talking with Brad Mielke on Start Here. The last 3 years, no matter who you are or what part of the world you're in, have been a difficult adjustment, but that adjustment just might be coming to an end, according to the White House at least, when they informed Congress Monday night that the COVID-19 emergency will be coming to an end in May. But what does that mean for the systems we've put in place to cope with the pandemic all this time? ABC's Cheyenne Hazlett had some details the night of the announcement.
The administration is very deliberately announcing the end of the emergencies pretty far in advance, hoping to soften the blow by giving all of these impacted systems and bureaucracies under the public health emergency and the national emergency a chance to maybe hold on to things that exist because of those emergencies that they don't want to lose, or to get ready to lose those things in a smoother way.
And what does this mean for millions of Americans? ABC's Ann Flaherty can tell us more about that.
This is an interesting issue. We've known this has been coming for a while. The administration seems to have been a little bit gun-shy about this. What they say is that as soon as they end the COVID restrictions, you can potentially knock millions of people off Medicaid. So when you establish an emergency declaration like this, people can jump on Medicaid, even though they technically don't qualify. It's those people, kind of the working poor people that don't necessarily meet those extreme poverty levels. So those people could potentially be knocked off of the government's insurance program. The question is, how are states going to help those people get some kind of insurance, particularly conservative states that haven't yet expanded their own Medicaid rolls? Now, conservatives make the argument that a lot of these people have probably found insurance elsewhere. A lot of these people possibly were uninsured because they lost their job in the pandemic. The economy has improved. They could be back on an employer's insurance. So it remains to be seen what the real impact is of this. But there's obviously concern that when the federal government pulls those emergency measures, that people will be forgotten and fall through the cracks.
I also spoke to Anne about another announcement from the White House this week that the Biden administration wants to make it harder for private health insurers to deny women access to free birth control coverage. And let's start with a little background on this rule the Biden administration's proposing.
This issue has been a political football for years. It's really at the forefront of these culture wars. So this question is, you know, should women be able to access birth control at no cost, or can employers who provide their health insurance be allowed to deny them that benefit based on religious or moral grounds? So, you know, under Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, insurers must cover preventative care and screenings. But it's really up to HHS to decide what qualifies as preventative care. So, you know, Obama really set off this debate when he said, well, I think that contraception and birth control is preventative care. And that posed a big problem for hospitals and charities run by religious organizations that said, we think that that violates our religious values. So it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And in 2014, the Supreme Court ruled that Hobby Lobby case, that for-profit corporations with sincerely held religious beliefs can be exempt from that rule. So, you know, you fast forward to President Trump, and the Trump administration came out with a regulation under HHS that said anyone with moral or religious reasons are exempt, and they do not have to provide access to free contraception through their healthcare plans. And in fact, he said instead, women who are seeking free contraception could go to these low-income clinics that get some support from the federal government. So that decision, that regulation was upheld by the Supreme Court in 2020. This was the case of the Little Sisters of the Poor. So now President Biden is looking at it and saying, you know, this hurts, potentially hurts a lot of women because their employer, really, it's pretty broad because anyone with a moral or religious reason could be exempt from this requirement. So what President Biden did this week, he proposed this rule that says it's going to make it harder for private insurers to deny women access to free birth control. And he's going to keep the religious conviction piece of it because that's been upheld in the Supreme Court in the Hobby Lobby case, but he's going to drop the idea that you can do it on moral grounds. So what President Biden is saying is that employers can still object to providing free contraception on religious grounds, but not on moral grounds. So they'll keep their religious conviction, but not the moral grounds. And really the reason why is this idea that, you know, with moral conviction, it really goes beyond religious freedoms and it allows businesses to exclude people simply because they personally disagreed with it. It wasn't a deeply held religious conviction. That's the argument of the Biden administration.
And this is something that does not have to go through the House and the Senate. It's something that the White House can authorize, right?
That's right. It doesn't have to go through Congress, but they can get sued. So I would expect that this could potentially end up in the courts.
We're in a divided government. We are divided politically. We have a court that's heavily conservative. And if this does go to the Supreme Court, it almost seems like a no-brainer that the justices would rule in favor of these for-profit companies that don't want to cover the cost. So why is the president doing this now?
Well, the president has said that it is a priority of him to expand access to birth control coverage, particularly in light of the fall of Roe versus Wade. So they've said that they have promised this to voters. They're going to make good on it. They can't control the courts. I do think it's interesting, though, because in 2018, when the Supreme Court upheld the Trump administration version of this, that employers could object on religious and moral grounds to exclude birth control from healthcare plans. It actually was upheld with two liberal justices. So Justices Kagan and Breyer said they do think it's up to the government to decide these matters. So that's actually legal precedent. So I think what the Biden administration is going to argue if this does end up going all the way to the Supreme Court is, you know, look, you guys have already decided that it's up to the government to decide such matters as what should be covered under this Affordable Care Act.
All indications say President Biden is going to run for re-election. So, Anne, do you expect this to be a major issue in the 2024 election?
You know, I think by the time you get to 2024, I don't think it's going to be about this specific rule, but I think that women's access to healthcare, women's access to abortion rights, it's going to remain on voters' minds. I think not just this access to birth control, this is one piece of a much, much bigger puzzle that Democrats are going to try to put together ahead of 2024 to get people out to vote to say, this is what we want. We want access to birth control. We want access to abortion rights. Now, conservatives say that they think they can come out stronger on this and that they can win on this issue. I think that all remains to be seen.
That was ABC's Ann Flaherty. Coming up, a Dallas Zoo mystery on Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Something is going on at the Dallas Zoo and has been since the beginning of the year. From enclosures tampered with to animals stolen or killed, ABC's Jim Ryan says the situation has gone from curious to criminal.
January 13th was a Friday, normally a busy day at the 110-acre Dallas Zoo, the largest in Texas. But on that Friday, a regular headcount of animals found one missing.
First thing this morning, our zoologists found that one of our two clouded leopards was not accounted for. So one is safe and sound in her habitat here at the zoo, but the other was MIA.
Harrison Edel, the executive vice president of animal care, said the Dallas Zoo was immediately closed. Guests were escorted to the main gate and a search was begun.
We triggered what we call a code blue, which essentially brings the staff resources that we need to find a non-dangerous animal that's not accounted for.
At around 23 pounds, Nova the clouded leopard is not much bigger than a house cat. Her small size and excellent tree climbing skills allowed her to elude capture for about 7 hours, but she was eventually found on zoo property, and by the next day, says the zoo's Tina Cloutier-Barber.
She's doing great. She got right back into her routine. Saturday afternoon, she was a little sleepy. She had a big day Friday, but she was really happy to be reunited with her sister. And this is all pretty routine for her, so she's doing all of the things that we hope that a cat would be doing.
During the search for Nova, zoo officials located something else.
We did locate the tear in the mesh that she used to leave the habitat.
And a similar tear in a nearby monkey enclosure. The Dallas Police Department's Kristen Lohman.
Part of the ongoing investigation is to see if they are related or they're not related.
Within days, the evidence that they were related and intentional would become clear. Harrison Edel says zookeepers were again performing the daily headcount of animals.
What we found was deemed to be very suspicious.
A lappet-faced vulture named Pin was discovered dead in its enclosure. It had been at the Dallas Zoo for over 3 decades.
This is an endangered species, which makes him all the more important to long-term sustainability of the vulture population.
Pin's death was not an accident. Edel says a postmortem turned up an intentionally inflicted wound.
And we're also really disturbed by the idea that someone might have intentionally done this.
So the escaped leopard, the cut fence around a primate enclosure, and the dead vulture, 3 suspicious incidents in a few days' time. But Dallas Zoo President Greg Hudson says,
we have over 100-plus cameras on zoo grounds monitoring public, staff, and exhibit areas. But since then, we have substantially increased our camera coverage, including portable solar tower units that the DPD has loaned us to help during this crisis, and have significantly increased the range on our 110-acre campus.
But all the security in the world couldn't prevent someone from sneaking into the zoo undetected, cutting open the enclosure around a pair of emperor tamarin monkeys and stealing the animals. Concern for them pushed a reward to $25,000, and police released a surveillance image of a person of interest who might have information. A tip led officers to an abandoned church in the Dallas suburb of Lancaster, and the monkeys, Bella and Finn, were discovered in a closet. Tanya Thomas is the daughter of the church pastor.
Whoever put the monkeys in there had to have used flashlights or something. It's cold, it's dark. They could have died in that house.
The monkeys were taken back to the zoo and were soon eating, drinking, and huddled up in their own habitat. Police said the location where Bella and Finn were found has been the subject of a previous investigation involving exotic animals being kept illegally. Meanwhile, the Dallas Zoo's Greg Hudson defends the current security measures, but promises more.
We have a robust security system that obviously has not worked over the past 3 weeks. So we are working extremely hard to bolster that with additional cameras and additional boots on the ground, as well as help from DPD and other outside sources.
The incidents here have zoo officials around the country taking a second look at their own security measures. Reporting for Perspective, Jim Ryan, ABC News, Dallas.
Late Thursday, Dallas police arrested a suspect in the disappearance of Finn and Bella and charged him with cruelty to animals. Coming up, one place produces more NFL players than anywhere else. On Perspective, after this. From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Daria Albinger. Coming up, the decades-long fight for black musicians in Vegas. But first, if you're looking for a career in the NFL, you might be in the wrong city if it isn't Rock Hill, South Carolina, also known as Football City. Rock Hill is like a professional football player factory with the amount of talent it produces. But with those big dreams come even higher expectations, and the story doesn't always mean the young phenoms make the cut. ABC's Michael Strahan traveled to Rock Hill to get a glimpse at the next future stars.
The Friday night lights are bright in Football City, USA.
Friday night high school football games are an American tradition.
This town, Rock Hill, South Carolina, called itself Football City, USA. With a population of about 75,000 people, it says it's turned out more NFL players per capita than any other city in the U.S. Tonight's high school stars could become tomorrow's next pro athletes.
You're one of the best wide receivers in the country. Is that a lot of pressure? Because you're only a freshman.
Nah, you can't let the game get bigger than yourself. I don't think about it too much.
Jazavian, at just 14 years old, already has multiple Division I offers to play in college.
Jay, when did you know he was this good?
By the time he was six, he had his first, I think, like eight touchdown season. By the time he was nine, on 9U, he had 30 touchdowns and had...
In one season.
And had three games, he had five touchdowns. One game, he had five touchdowns in the first quarter. We always prepared for him to get this much attention.
For some, those big dreams pay off. And big contracts in a successful career.
Man.
But Jabril Fuel knows all too well what happens when that dream bursts. Jabril was one of those high school phenom players everyone said would make it to the NFL. He played college ball, but didn't make the cut for the NFL.
How did that feel to come back here after not, you know, hitting the ultimate dream of making the NFL?
It was depressing. I felt like a failure. And I didn't know what was really next, so I kind of went into a dark area.
Jabril is now a youth football coach, helping kids learn how to bounce back when football ends. He brings in mental health advocates and even former players to help kids think beyond the game.
Repeat after me, say, my identity is greater than my ability.
Once people realize that football is 90% mental, 10% physical, they'll understand how important a mental health piece is to the football piece.
That was ABC's Michael Strahan. If you'd like to catch the full story, you can watch Impact by Nightline on Hulu. Imagine being one of the brightest stars and one of the biggest draws, yet the rules for you were a little different. That's what it was like for black performers on the Las Vegas Strip, only being allowed on the stage while being segregated. ABC's Janae Norman takes us behind the curtain.
Las Vegas, one of America's playgrounds. But in the 1940s and 50s, people of color were only welcome on the stage.
How crazy it was that these great entertainers could sell out the showroom, help the casino be successful because of those people, and yet couldn't stay there, couldn't gamble.
Imagine driving up to the front of the casino and your name is in lights and you can't walk through the front door. You have to go around the back because you're black. But it's like, that's my name. I'm performing here tonight.
Segregation was the rule in Vegas, as it was throughout most of the country. ABC News spoke to Sammy Davis Jr. about the difficulties he faced.
You couldn't get a room where you were working then.
No, you could work the place. We couldn't even eat in the place.
Performers like Sammy Davis Jr., Lena Horne, and Josephine Baker all spoke out against the discrimination they endured. But their push for equality, combined with the longtime work of civil rights organizations like the NAACP, made a difference. In 1971, change would come by way of an important legal agreement.
So people at the NAACP put together a consent decree, where they name 17 hotel casinos, 5 labor unions, and the Nevada Resorts Association for not having done enough for black employment in this city. Therefore, the consent decree then demands 12% of jobs in a whole array of job categories for the African American community.
Today, casinos host black artists and superstars who perform night after night to sold-out crowds.
I feel like black entertainers in Las Vegas crawled and scraped so that we could fly. If not for the struggles they endured, there would be no possibility of somebody like me getting to go back to my hometown and perform on some of the biggest stages in Vegas.
You can watch the full show Black in Vegas, A Soul of a Nation, an ABC News production on Hulu. Coming up, facial recognition technology is now putting people on edge. On Perspective, after this. Think for a minute about how many pictures of yours there are on the internet. Posting selfies has become almost second nature to many of us. There's also probably pictures of you with your friends out there, maybe a headshot on your job's website too. But a growing controversy here in New York over the use of facial recognition technology has many worried about just what those photos are being used for. ABC's Mike DeBusky reports.
The Rockettes are some of the most renowned dancers in the world, wowing Radio City Music Hall audiences with their high-kicking performances. But in recent months, that venue, Radio City, has been kicking up a controversy. Attorney Kelly Conlon says she was refused entry from the Rockettes' Christmas Spectacular over the holidays because her firm was engaged in legal action against Radio City's owner, MSG Entertainment.
And they're on their feet at the Garden, cheering the Rangers.
And it's not just Rockettes fans. Benjamin Pinchesky, a lawyer at a different firm that's also representing a client suing MSG Entertainment, was barred from a New York Rangers game at Madison Square Garden last month.
They escorted me out of the building in front of everyone, and I was back in the street. So I got myself a pretzel, and I went home.
And Benjamin Norin, another attorney, another law firm, recorded himself being refused entry to a Knicks game.
So your ticket is not valid for you. The ticket has been revoked and you are not permitted in the building.
Norin's co-worker, Larry Hutcher, was barred as well.
I have never had action taken against me as a lawyer because of something I have done within the context of my job.
The lawyers allege MSG Entertainment picked them out of throngs of people at these events using facial recognition technology.
It is very dystopian. It is very 1984-ish.
Mac DeGarin covers tech policy and privacy at Gizmodo. He says facial recognition tech can be separated into two categories.
What researchers call one-to-one facial match. And that's something you might see at, say, if you're coming in from like customs at the airport, they scan your passport against a database.
That's different from what MSG Entertainment is under fire for, because they use a process known as one-to-many.
So that would be like, in an example, when you walk into a place and someone scans a face of many different people, and then it's comparing that against another database.
We don't know a ton of detail about the specific system it uses, but DeGuerin says that one-to-many facial recognition technologies generally work by gathering images of people's faces and then placing distinct data points on those images.
So it can be on your forehead, on your cheeks, all these different areas that are then used to estimate if you match someone in their database.
And that database can be made up of pretty much any public image, even pictures posted to social media. Officials at MSG have said their database is comprised of people they deem security threats, and that they even have signage posted at their properties telling visitors facial recognition technology is being used. DeGuerin says detractors argue that message doesn't square with what's been happening to the lawyers.
I think most regular viewers going to a show would not necessarily interpret that to mean, hey, you might be on a list because of X reason that really has nothing to do with security.
A representative for MSG told ABC News that the company does not unlawfully prohibit anyone from entering their venues and that they are merely excluding a percentage of lawyers only during active litigation. Last month, New York Attorney General Letitia James announced they were looking into MSG Entertainment's use of facial recognition, sending a letter to Dolan requesting information about how the company uses the technology. New York State lawmakers have also introduced legislation intended to protect people's right to attend public performances. NYU law professor Randy Milch says the proposal is an update to an existing civil rights law.
You're not permitted to refuse admission or to eject otherwise peaceable people from a public performance. And this is really aimed at performances at music halls, so-called legitimate theaters, burlesque theaters, opera houses, dance halls. So it may be that New York law would say you can't exclude people from Mariah Carey, but you could exclude people from the Knicks.
MSG Entertainment tells ABC, quote, "To even suggest anyone is being excluded based on the protected classes identified in state and federal civil rights laws is ludicrous." Reporting for Perspective, I'm Mike Tobusky, ABC News.
ABC's Lindsay Davis is out with another children's book, her fifth to be exact, and this one tackles a pretty complex issue, the Human Genome Project. She sat down to talk about it with Perspective's Sherry Preston this week.
The book is called The Smallest Spot of a Dot. Little ways we're different, big ways we're the same. Lindsay wrote it with her friend Michael Tyler, and the illustrations are by Lucy Fleming. Lindsay Davis says most of her other children's books were inspired by her own soon-to-be 9-year-old son.
This one actually just came from my own interest in the Human Genome Project. I've really long been fascinated with that, which was thousands of researchers from around the world, considered largely to be one of the biggest global comprehensive scientific projects ever. And the first phase of it basically set out to attempt to determine the blueprint of human DNA. And what they found was that 99.9% of our DNA is just alike, is identical. And it's only 0.1%, that 0.1% difference that makes us unique. And that's what might determine our hair color or our blood type. And so I found that really fascinating. And I had done a book before called One Big Heart, which was really about celebrating, you know, our differences and our similarities. But this I felt would be even more profound because it's based scientifically.
But how do you explain that to a 4 to 8-year-old, which is who this book is meant for?
When I was thinking about how could I explain this to someone who's as young as 4 years old and them understand it, and I was talking to a friend of mine, Michael Tyler, and he said, what if we use dots? And I was like, that's a great idea, because when you look at the system, our DNA, it's made up of 3.1 billion molecules. And so if you think about that, all is this like various array of dots, of billions of dots, and then that you have just a few. And in this case, we called it the me, my mind dot, the thing that makes me shine dot. It's that kind of unique dot that each of us has that separates us from everybody else, because like, how fun would it be if we were all just alike and identical and the same. And so I think that it's a way to celebrate our similarities as well as embracing our differences.
In addition to being the author of five books, of course, Lindsay is also the anchor of ABC News Live Prime with Lindsay Davis, which has been streaming for almost exactly 3 years now. I asked her how that show is different than all the other things she does here at ABC News.
Yeah, it's a totally different ball of wax. So I still do, at the same time, anchor World News Tonight on Sundays, which is, you know, a 30-minute broadcast. But by the time you have commercials and all of that, it's probably maybe 22 minutes of news. So we're really just doing the headlines of the day and just giving you kind of a little excerpt. So it's kind of like the little tasting menu of, you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And then that's it. With ABC News Live Prime, we have an hour and a half. So it's three times as long. So we have the luxury of time and we're able to really delve into, as I like to say, the humanity behind the headlines and really get into the nuggets and the nuance beyond what you might just see as far as the top stories of the day.
And as if she wasn't doing enough, Lindsay also anchors the ABC News Radio iNet newscast at 5 o'clock Eastern time every afternoon.
From ABC News, I'm Lindsay Davis. Anchor
Before Prime. I used to say, well, I have 1 foot in streaming and I have 1 foot in linear. Now I have radio as well. So I have a hand. I'm like Twister, you know, with the hands all over the red spots and blue spots and all that. But it's fun. And I hope that we're reaching into a different pool of potential viewers for the show. So.
And listen, yeah, exactly. Viewers for the show and listeners for us. It sounds great, and we love having you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Coming up, Punxsutawney Phil saw his shadow, but is he right? On Perspective, after this. February 2nd was Groundhog Day at Gobbler's Knob, the annual ceremony where Punxsutawney Phil predicts whether there will be an early spring or six more weeks of winter. We sat down with Phil, his handler, and the president of the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club to learn more about the amateur weatherman.
I see a shadow.
For 137 years, the United States has turned to one prognosticator when it comes to determining the end of winter and the start of spring, a groundhog, Punxsutawney Phil. This week, he predicted six more weeks of winter.
It's six more weeks of winter weather.
His historical average is less than 50%. People travel far and wide to catch a glimpse of Phil, making his prediction. Phil's handler, A.J. DeRoom, has his own name for the trek to town.
A pilgrimage.
Now, the average groundhog lives 3 to 4 years, but Phil has been with us for more than 130. Seriously? Groundhog Club president Tom Dunkel says it's because Phil drinks what they call the elixir of life.
Every 3 or 4 years, you don't get a new Easter Bunny. Phil's the same way. He drinks the elixir of life, and it's always the same Punxsutawney Phil.
Well, now that Phil's biggest day of the year has come and gone, he and Phyllis will enjoy a nice long nap.
Now he's back by that door. Let's see.
Oh, he's eating the corn that I brought in there.
And feast on their favorites, peanuts and corn on the cob. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. The show is produced by Aaron Ferrer and Marwa Mwaki. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger.